Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to Oh God, What Now? I'm Dorian Linsky. To quote Liz Truss, why me? Why now? On today's show, we've read Truss's new book, 10 Years to Save the West, so you don't have to. We'll discuss what light it sheds on her 49 days of chaos and the precarious state of the conservative mind. Plus, Rishi Sunak's smoking ban has now passed its first vote in the Commons, despite significant opposition from Tory MPs. Labour and health professionals back this radical plan to eventually abolish smoking altogether, but libertarians claim that it sets a dangerous precedent by dividing legally competent adults into two categories based on when they were born. We'll discuss the principles at stake. And in the extra bit for supporters, Alex Garland's movie Civil War is out now in cinemas and generating confusion and controversy. What does it say about our divided politics in a perilous election year for America? And we have exciting live news too. But first, let's meet the panel. First up, it's political commentator Alex Andreou. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Dorian.
The Rwanda bill has been getting a kicking in the House of Lords. What is the latest?
Well, okay, so it got a kicking. Four amendments passed back to the Commons. This afternoon, Wednesday, as we record, the Commons have voted to reject all four amendments again, have sent it back to the Lords. The expectation was that at this point the Lords would fold because Labour doesn't want to appear to be blocking the policy. And actually, because in many ways the act going through is Rishi Sunak's worst nightmare, because then he has to actually make it happen, and it's far from simple. But the latest I've heard as we record is that Labour will put down two of the four amendments again, which probably means that it will go back to the Commons, and it won't go back to the Commons tonight. They're saying they will do it later in the day so that it goes back to the Commons tomorrow. So just strap in for an interesting period.
Next, it's political correspondent for The Independent, Zoe Grunewald. Hi, Zoe.
Hello.
You attended a lobby briefing by More in Common, which revealed what voters think of Rishi Sunak. It's not great news for the big man, is it?
No. Surprisingly, another terrible set of focus group results for Rishi Sunak. So to sum up, voters don't like him. They don't like his policy. And the only group he's managing to maintain some support with are the kind of old Shire Tories. So the really kind of, you know, I would say wealthier blue Tories. The headline was that 6 in 10 voters say there is absolutely 0% chance they will vote Conservative at the next election. Pretty dire.
Right.
Voters, also, I thought this was quite interesting. By no means was this the headline, but actually more voters in the focus groups that More in Common have been conducting say Sunak is boring than Starmer. And considering that is one of the key insults that's levelled at Starmer.
Wow. That's interesting.
Yeah, I would say that's quite interesting. The other headline was that Rishi Sunak had made the wrong political choice by cutting national insurance in the spring budget. And actually voters cared far more, or would have cared far more, about income tax cuts or cost of living policies like an energy price cap or a cap to price of groceries and goods. So basically, not only do people not like Sunak on a personal level, they don't like his rabbit out of a hat policy. Actually, there was more enthusiasm for Keir Starmer in focus groups than people were saying. So all in all, another terrible, terrible day for Rishi Sunak.
Oh, dear.
Wow. Our special guest this week is actor and impressionist Jan Ravens. Hello, Jan.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for coming. Education Secretary Gillian Keegan plans to cut funding for performing and creative arts courses in universities. Why does this government insist on seeing the arts as a trivial bit of fun rather than one of the UK's most successful industries around the world?
It's quite extraordinary. I mean, it makes millions and billions of pounds for this country, and they seem determined to cut it in schools and to cut specialist university courses. And cutting it in schools is not only a bad idea because, you know, imagination is, you know, as Ken Robinson said in his TED talk all those years ago, you know, creativity is, you know, one of our best resources. To just kind of encourage children to regurgitate information that already exists is not going to solve any of the world's problems. And also, there's a quality of life issue there, I think, you know, with school kids. I mean, obviously, once students get to university, they're choosing their specialities, and that's really important too because of the creative industries. But as far as school's concerned, things like music and drama are so important and can teach you so many other lessons than those things themselves.
Mm. Woke, though, innit?
Oh, it's woke, though, innit? Yeah, yeah.
Before we start, we've got some exciting news about live shows. Oh God, What Now is treading the boards once again in a brand new venue, the new King's Head Theatre in Islington, North London, home of the sandal-wearing anti-growth coalition that brought Liz Truss down. Roz, Alex and I, plus a special guest to be announced soon, will be live on stage on Monday, 20th of May, with the traditional mix of insightful analysis, open-mouthed astonishment and fine quality jokes. We'll have the local election results to pick over, and maybe the Conservatives will lay a leadership challenge on for us too as a little treat. Tickets are on sale now. There's a link at the top of the show notes. You can book right away. And Patreon people, you can still get £4 off tickets with your special discount code. Just check the Patreon page. That's Oh God, What Now? It's Grim Up North London, Monday, 20th of May at the new King's Head off Upper Street. See you there, wokesters. If you're familiar with the Shaggy hit It Wasn't Me, you'll already have the gist of Liz Truss's self-pitying new memoir, 10 Years to Save the West. When I tweeted about reading it, many people asked if I bought it myself for reading pleasure, which I consider a libelous suggestion. We have read it for money and audio content, and we're here to give you the juiciest nuggets of paranoia and delusion from the self-proclaimed Brian Clough of Prime Ministers. To give you an idea, she would like to get rid of the following: the Human Rights Act, the Equality Act, the Climate Change Act, the European Court of Human Rights, the UN Refugee Convention, the Office of Budget Responsibility, the Supreme Court, National Insurance, Inheritance Tax, and a politically independent civil service. But she didn't have time. Her enemies include, and I think we probably have all of them on this show, fashionable ideas, vested interests, elites, groupthink, orthodoxy, virtue signalling, political correctness, identity politics, the blob, the deep state, net zero, fads, snobbery, sneering, bien pensant, naysayers, the French philosopher Michel Foucault, wokeism and wokery, which are apparently different things. She then mocks Remainers for acting like the infamous enemies of the people attack on judges, which you remember during Brexit.
Yeah.
Acting like it was the beginning of the end of civilization as we know it, unlike her level-headed claim that we have 10 years to save the West. They're very different things. Jen, we'll have some highlights for you to read out later.
Yes, well, there are many, obviously.
Can you explain how to capture the unique music of Liz Truss's voice?
Well, you just have to imagine that, you know, you're a kind of... she's a cross between a sort of haunted doll... and a little girl whose daddy always told her she was funny, who is constantly looking round and expecting applause and laughter. I mean, she's getting the laughter, that's for sure.
She does say in the book that once again her irreverence had got her into trouble. As if that was her abiding quality.
Well, I think, because one of the funny things is that she casts herself as this kind of, I'm instinctively anti-establishment, you know, fighting orthodoxy, like hashtag maverick, hashtag renegade. I mean, she sort of clearly sees herself as this kind of, you know, beacon in a world of dull kind of conformity.
Were you professionally disappointed that she was gone so soon? Obviously, this is a delightful encore.
Well, yes. I mean, she's the gift that keeps on giving. She just keeps bouncing back.
She's the gift that keeps on giving.
Yes. She's so deluded and so sort of completely untrammeled by any kind of self-doubt. And she seems to be sort of with this book sort of doing the opposite of what she thinks she's doing. Because she says... I could write a whole book identifying what went wrong, complaining about the unfairness of it all, and justifying the choices I made. Maybe I will do that one day. And you sort of think, hello.
Yes. And she goes, now there is no time for finger pointing. Cue 300 pages of finger pointing. Amazing. So, Alex, based on the finger pointing, in brief, if you will. Who does she think is to blame for the failure of her Trussian revolution?
In brief, everyone who isn't her, her husband, or her daughters. That's the shortest version of it. I mean, she blames the media, her own party, her staff, her cabinet, the civil service, the OBR, economists in general, the market, woke corporations who have moved too far to the left, that is a quote, bankers and the elites, and on it goes. She really hates the Bank of England. She really hates the Bank of England and the governor of the Bank
And, of course, Kwasi Kwarteng.
Yeah. And so I think the book fails on its most basic thesis, because she says this establishment fought me and this is why it all went wrong. But she came through that establishment to grotesque overpromotion. So the establishment was helpful to her up until she got to a job that she couldn't do so spectacularly obviously that she was jettisoned. But right up until that point, everything was fine, you know. Her cabinet was stuffed with public school educated people, more than Johnson's, more than Cameron's, 85%. It contained five bankers, four lawyers, and five accountants, and nobody that had done any public service job at all. So for her to now turn around and say, oh, it's the bankers and the lawyers that did it. Yeah, they did. You kind of picked them.
Well, one consistent theme seems to be a lack of awareness that she and her ideas, I could stop there.
Generally,
But that she and her ideas are not, in fact, popular. So she talks about, why am I, this is a room full of world leaders, why am I the only conservative in the room? And then in another case, when she wants to cancel...
Because you went to the wrong room again, love.
When she wants to cancel COP26, she goes, once again, I was in a minority of one. And I just thought, is this sort of classic unpopulism that she doesn't realise that the silent masses don't actually want Singapore on Thames after all?
So on lack of self-awareness, I think this quote is the most astounding in the book. She says, I had become increasingly concerned that Britain's judiciary had become a self-perpetuating oligarchy. Here was a group of similarly minded people from similar backgrounds who had a particular worldview and were resolute in protecting their own interests. Ooh. And you think, just read that back to yourself a couple of times. Just see if it sounds like any other group we know. I mean, one only needs to look at the list of luminaries in the inside cover that endorse her book, ranging from Alison Pearson and Daniel Hannan, who famously never wrong about stuff, all the way to Ted Cruz, to know what...
Do you think it was a bit needy that if you used to run a country, normally when you put out a book, like that's the sell. Like if you're Barack Obama and you put out your book, it's just the blurb is you.
It's
Barack Obama's book. And here there's like about eight blurbs, which is more than like a very needy, you know, sort of first-time novelist.
But all of them appeal to a different little segment of the conspiracy community.
Right.
I thought.
Zoe, let's talk about Truss the politician. She seems to think here that the lesson to take from Margaret Thatcher's success is that politics is a battle and a fight and an attack and sort of you don't need to really persuade anybody, which is not in fact how Margaret Thatcher operated. She also seems to think that that Reagan's Cold War diplomacy was just being very, very tough. Again, not how it worked. You know, he had to sort of sit down with Gorbachev and so on. Is she fundamentally just not, I mean, obviously she's not good at politics, but it's one reason why she's not good at politics is that she just doesn't like understand what politics is.
Well, I think there's a few things in the way she's described her politics in the book. I think the first is that obviously she felt that in order to sell her book and get that very fruitful £1,500 advance, which is quite small, Boris Johnson got...
Is that what she got?
She got, yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, Boris Johnson got 500,000.
She got a grand and a half.
Yes. So anyway, to make up the lost funding of her tiny book advance, she probably thought, I'm going to have to talk in quite extreme terms. I need to make this exciting. So you talk about all the decisions you've made as fights, as battles, because that's way more interesting than saying, actually, I had a 3-hour sit down with the trade envoy for so-and-so and it was all, you know, very diplomatic. But I do think there's something else here, which is that actually we are seeing a shift in conservative, particularly conservative rhetoric, about politics being like a battlefield and about having to fight, and especially conservative women. So Penny Mordaunt at Conservative Party conference last year, she did that insane speech.
And if you stand up and fight, the person next to you stands up and fights.
It's obviously it tells us something about the way in which the right of the Conservative Party is moving, is kind of mobilising, and how they are positioning their foes as these kind of enemies to war against. But I think there's also probably something quite gendered about it, which is that if you are a woman trying to get your perspective across, you have to come across as very, very tough, and you have to talk in those terms. So I think it's a little bit, I mean, I don't want to defend her and say, it's because she's struggling as a woman in politics, but I have noticed that there is a toughening of language amongst female politicians here.
She has that kind of contrast as well in the book, you know, between this kind of, I'm battling against orthodoxy and I'm, you know, he who would valiant be kind of thing. But she also has this thing where it's kind of like a teenage diary. I mean, there's one bit where she says, my cabinet colleague Andrea Leadsom, the leader of the House of Commons, formed the Pizza Club, a group of us who favoured a clean break from the EU. We would get together in her office, sometimes with actual pizzas, and talk about how we could get Brexit done. It was more like a therapy session than anything else. I mean, like, the kind of person who has no idea what a therapy session is like, you know, that's not what a therapy session is like.
It's not having pizza with Andrea Leadsom.
No, it's really not.
No.
So, and, you know,
that is usually the cause of needing therapy. Yes.
Well, there's some revealing glimpses of self-criticism, though. It's not fair to say there are none. She goes, it's fair to say I perhaps not spent enough time during my career listening to and empathising with my parliamentary colleagues. I'm not always good at translating my internal dialogue into something for wider public communication. I like people, but even my best friends wouldn't describe me as a great people manager. Like, if you know this, why would you think you would be a good prime minister in which you have to do things like talk to the public and deal with people?
See, I don't think this is self-criticism. I think this is quite self-congratulatory. It's like, no, I don't have time for empathy or communicating with people or managing people. I've got a battle to win. I'm an innovator. I'm a maverick. I'm a genius. And I don't have time for all these silly things that other leaders do that just waste their time.
It's woke to be, my ideas
to people. It's woke to manage people and it's woke to communicate properly. And there was a bit that really stood out to me when she was talking about Sue Gray. And she spoke about how when she left Downing Street, she had to see Sue Gray. I think it was when she was demoted, and she said, to my surprise, she took it upon herself to commiserate with me by giving me a hug before telling me that as a result of my demotion, my salary was being cut. I didn't welcome her unsolicited embrace. I am not a hugger, but given how delicate I was feeling, she got off lightly. I mean, there's almost a moment of
what
vulnerability.
A it's
like, well, you know, if I hadn't, if you know, if I hadn't been feeling, I would have lamped her.
Yeah, exactly. It's like there's almost
fucking
a moment of
me, Sue,
of vulnerability.
I've told you before, Sue. Yeah.
It becomes a bit dark and a bit threatening, and I feel like she's trying to present herself as quite cold, quite, you know, I guess masculine in some ways, but also that she just doesn't have time for any of that wishy-washy feelings crap.
Well, there's these weird little tidbits. Where, like, there's one where she reveals that her parents were CND members and they take on CND marches. And then a few pages later, she says that CND undermined the West and helped the Soviets. And I'm just like, I don't think I'd say that about my parents,
my
who appear
Dad,
to be quite nice people, you know, who have presumably supported her through a terrible humiliation. So, yeah, there's a lot of psychological weirdness. Alice, I want to talk to you about the idea that perhaps we can read this as like a novel with an unreliable narrator. Because she obviously loves the loosely regulated free market. Then she complains that she was brought down by something called liability-driven investments, which is one of those kind of weird financial instruments that turns that seems like a really good idea until it causes complete havoc. And the global market. There's a bit where she says, I came to realize there's no such thing as the market in this sense. Rather, there are groups of influential individuals in the financial establishment. So it's, oh, the market isn't magic.
But then she says the financial crisis was not in itself a bad thing, but used by the left to discredit free markets. But she's sort of given away the fact that there is a real problem with free markets and that it was the markets that killed her.
There is a psychological defense in there that once you can either not let a crack of self-doubt in, or it will come flooding in. And I think it feels to me like there's a part of her that knows that, that it has to be either a complete stonewalling of anything that could have been done to me, or I will have to, you know, stand in front of myself in the mirror and account for myself.
She will have to go to therapy, you know, yeah.
But and the leaks in the dam is what makes it a weirdly interesting read.
Because every now and then you see that she knows.
These
contradictions, which I think are extraordinary, the thrust of the book is that we need completely different policies, right? That this is urgent stuff, that if we don't change it, we're heading for disaster, right? But it contains three leadership contests. And I looked at them really carefully, and everything she says is, oh, I liked him. She was difficult. They were nice. She does not mention a single policy. She presents herself as this person who is obsessed with the right policies, but when choosing a leader for her own party, she's basically like someone watching, you know, Love Island and thinking, oh, I'll vote for him. He has nice abs. I mean...
Well, at one point, you know, I was thinking, is she basically somebody like a think tank wonk who shouldn't be in politics? But then you start getting into the kind of the intellectual quality of this. She has a go at Foucault twice, clearly never having read a word of Foucault, but read a blog about him.
He'd be distraught.
She knows one line from Martin Luther King, which she doesn't understand. She accidentally, I hope... cites a dubious quote attributed to Maya Rothschild in an anti-Semitic book which claims the world is ruled by the international money masters. Mm. Does she actually grasp most of what she's talking about, particularly when you get into sort of wokeism and identity politics? I mean, critical race, these are quite complicated ideas. Did you get the feeling sometimes that she's literally just had no clue?
No clue. And has never had a clue. Mm. Because what she accuses other people of being weather vanes and of triangulation, is precisely how she has fashioned her career. You know, she gave up that party because this party presented her with better opportunities. She backed that leadership candidate instead of this leadership candidate. After the vote on Brexit, she abandoned her objections to Brexit. She does that all the time. So what I think it is much more sinister than stupid. I think it is a grab bag of things that will ingratiate her to far right and conspiracy loons.
Well, she says she has credentials as an environmentalist from when she was in the Lib Dems, and then never actually talks about climate change as a thing. She goes on and on about net zero and how Greens are actually communists in disguise. Never says like one thing about why you might want to do something about climate change. It's like, well, she obviously knows. Mm. She obviously had that phase, but that's not convenient.
I know. I thought it was quite interesting, all the kind of quotes this week about, you know, I wanted to cancel COP26 and, you know, the kind of the wokerati going on about climate change. You know, cut to floods in Dubai airport. You know, you think, are you looking at this in the launch of this book where you've written all this stuff about...
She was
about,
environment,
you know,
secretary when she was going, the reason I couldn't think about Brexit was because I was distracted by all these floods. And it's like, have a think.
Yeah. Also, Johnson was... pretty big on environment stuff when he was prime minister, and she supported him. As you say, it just feels very cynical.
There is a single sentence about her support for Brexit during the campaign, which I think is quite extraordinary. She says that I was very much in two minds, and it was loyalty for Cameron mainly that swung it, da 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 da. And then she says, once I had decided to support Remain, then my campaigning persona took over.
Oh, no. And that's why we left the European Union.
And then the vote happens, basically, and she changes her mind. So that ellipsis is basically all the stuff that she said during that campaign, which is, it's a terrible idea, need the single market. She just goes, well, I was just in campaigning mode, wasn't I? I didn't believe any of it, which I find quite extraordinary.
And she goes on to complain. Yeah, and she goes on and on complaining about how Theresa May kind of soft-pedaled during the negotiations.
Oh, give us a tiny bit of Theresa, please.
Well, yes, Theresa was very, very sort of, can we just go through the details one more time, because I need to do all my homework and be very, very detailed about this. And Theresa was all about the tension. She had no way of saying, let's all have a chat and let's kind of make a deal here. But Liz was kind of apparently going into the negotiations in Europe, sort of saying, the only thing they understand is pain.
Oh, yeah.
What? I mean, what? That's fantastic.
You know,
it?
She was complaining that Theresa was far, you know, soft pedaling too much.
She also complains that Theresa May served undercooked barbecue chicken. At Checkers.
With
so
equal
it's not
vigor.
Like Andrea's pizza. Mm.
With equal vigour. And that's one of the extraordinary things. I think Matt Green described it as a sort of two-star Yelp review of various things. That is like, you know, oh, didn't think much of Checkers. Bit damp. The furniture wasn't delivered on time. The chicken was undercooked. It really is weird in that way.
Zoe, I'm worried that we've been a little harsh. Let us be generous for a moment. What is she right about in here? Does she identify any, like, I thought she identified, like, some genuine things?
Yeah. Okay, a broken clock is right twice a day, isn't it? So you can, you know, she's very hawkish on China, and we've seen recently that that is perhaps a fairly reasonable position to take with all the threats that we've had.
Putin,
to
I think she's...
Yeah, she's probably right about Putin. I mean, most MPs would agree with that. We know that Johnson was very strong in Ukraine, and she is, or was, probably still is in some ways, a Johnsonite.
Sorry to interrupt. I read in the book, actually, that she was saying, you know, if only we'd intervened sooner, you know, with Ukraine, Putin would never have invaded. And I sort of thought, really? Is that true, do you think?
2014, yeah. I think maybe there is that argument. I mean, who knows? But what bothers me more right now is that she's ardently endorsing Donald Trump while the Republicans are thwarting aid to Ukraine. And so it's like you literally cannot be tough on Putin and support Ukraine and support Trump. It's like it's impossible.
Yeah, that's incoherent. And that's something that I think is going to be a big geopolitical issue for any leader. Just to go back to Truss, the one thing I found myself not agreeing with but being slightly sympathetic to was that she didn't have anyone to do her hair. I just thought, as one of the most photographed women, who's very, very busy in number 10, actually a good use of her time, rather than giving herself a 20-minute blow-dry, would be to have someone do it for her. I kind of thought that was fair enough.
Well, there is a bit also, she talks about medical care and just about the support. And I just did an origin story, a little bonus episode with Ian Dunt. And he was talking about how Downing Street is just, it's a real kind of like shambles, and that basically it's not fit for purpose. And that there are lots of ways in which the Prime Minister's job is much more difficult than it could be. And I thought, on that very sort of micro level of just like it's hard being Prime Minister, not in a kind of petulant Rishi Sunak way, but literally going, somebody, the only person left in the building, had to like rush out to an all-night chemist to get her some medicine.
Yeah.
And you just thought, oh, actually, that I found quite revealing.
And very different to the White House.
Yeah. Yes.
And, you know,
paracetamol coming out of your arse in the White House.
I think the problem is it's very hard to sympathise with her on anything. But I think if you were going to take that out of it, if it was Theresa May, for example, who had said that, I think some people would have gone, yeah, I thought maybe she would have someone to do her hair. I can understand that could be a bit annoying.
And quite a lot is in retrospect. Like, she identifies loads of stuff that is obviously quite right, but a lot of it is like, well, I thought that at the time, but I didn't say anything. And it's like, you know, if you think China is a massive danger, did you pipe up in Cameron's cabinet, who was absolutely in bed with China for 6 years?
There's one line where I actually did feel a twinge of sympathy, where she went, most children find out about the fallibilities of their parents over a number of years. Mine saw all of mine publicly exposed in very short order. Mm. And I just feel like, do you know what? I think she could have, you know, I think she could have written a bit more about the sort of emotional experience of fucking up that badly
and what it's like when you have to turn up at the, you know, the cenotaph with all the other proper prime ministers.
And then one of them crops you out of the photo.
Yeah. Just like the weirdness of failure on that scale. But of course, the whole her whole political project now is denial and cognitive dissonance and finding other people to blame. So of course, she can't. But every, like I said, it leaks this book. Yeah. And every now and then there's a line where you just go, oh, that's something real. And then she just moves on and blames like people pulling down statues or something.
She was PM for the same number of days that David Blaine stayed in the glass box. That's my favourite bit of trivia.
But as she points out, a longer than Brian Clough was at Leeds. Right. As seen in the movie The Damned United. which I do actually believe she has seen.
Yeah.
So it sounds to me, what's weird about this is that a lot of the time she's pressing all these kind of populist buttons that we associate with the NatCons. And the whole thing about that, in that kind of the, you know, that sort of Matt Goodwin world, is that you're very bigoted, but also you give people money. The state gives people money. That's the realignment. So is there any future in this sort of popcorn neo-Thatcherite version of conservatism, but with sort of bigotry sprinkles? Like, it just seems to me like a narrow slice of the electorate.
I just feel like it's getting harder and harder to keep up with the various factions of conservatism and how it's evolving and who sits in what category. And, are you... Okay, I know you don't like abortion rights, and I know you don't like same-sex marriage, but do you like the free state, or do you hate austerity? I can't remember. And it's all becoming like that. And I think I have to agree with Alex. I just feel it was like she just ticked every box. You know, she was like, I'm going to have some of that, and I'm going to have some of that, and I'm going to have some of that. I mean, she was. I remember when she was going for the leadership, everyone said she is the Johnson continuity candidate. So she's going to be
including Johnson.
She's going to be fairly big state. She's going to do a lot of spending. She was going to always be, you know, way less charismatic, in inverted commas, than Boris Johnson. But now, it's just, it's that seems very far apart from how we see her.
We see her
as this sort of, you know, ultra kind of libertarian right-wing figure. And I think this is why this book feels very revisionist to me, because I feel like she is thinking about how she wants to be seen now and how she thinks it will serve her. And so she's rewriting her time in office to say, actually, I was always this person. Well, we know that you weren't. I mean, she used to be a Lib Dem, as we've said. There are so many things that are incoherent.
And it turns out that she spent there was one bit where I was just like, don't just do that in a sentence. She spent a year in communist Poland as a toddler. And I'm like, why? What?
Yeah. Why
and then she just like moves on.
Yeah.
So I really want to read another book by Liz Truss, but it felt like...
But there was a much more interesting book to be
done. An interesting book about this weird person. But this is essentially a job application. What job is she going for?
It's a good question. You know, she was making all the noises about potentially wanting to be conservative leader again. It's like she's just hedging her bets, and she's trying to put a little bit out there in every camp so she can try and shore up votes. I mean, she was never a Suella Braverman figure. We always knew who Suella was. But now she's kind of trying to compete with that. It's like she knows the way that the wind is going. She knows that for some reason there is this steam picking up behind Kemi Badenoch and Suella Braverman and these very kind of, you know, right-leaning figures. But she doesn't have it. It's not convincing.
Whatever it is, she does not have it. I don't want it, by the way.
I think what it speaks to is her understanding, which she shares with Cameron, with Johnson, and with Sunak, actually, of democracy as majoritarianism. So she thinks, if I end up in X position, you know, in her case, by just the party members voting for her, in Sunak's case, not even that, then suddenly all the people who voted against me need to fall in line. All my MPs, the civil service, my staff and the country owe me fealty. And I should be able to say, do X, and it's done. She doesn't understand that in a democratic country, you need to explain what you're going to do and try and take people with you.
And the minorities still have rights, and you don't just crush the opposition. There's a mad claim that the civil service is far too left-wing. And it did make me think, if Jeremy Corbyn had won, like say in 2017, would that have been his impression on week one?
just goes bunch of lefties around here. Like it was just that idea that because you're so far right, not far, literally far right, so you were so far to the right, that everybody is left wing. Like the Bank of England is too left wing.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you're bound to be disappointed.
The markets, you know, day traders are too left wing.
We're going to finish off with a special treat. Jan, I would like to give out some awards for my favourite lines from the book. And could you please read them for me in Trussian style?
In Trussian, okay.
Do you speak Trussian? Most touching response to the death of a monarch.
Why me? Why now?
Most delightful hubris.
I felt a sense of elation. Next to me, Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng was grinning from ear to ear. Kwasi had just announced the growth plan, which has since become known as the mini budget in the House of Commons.
Most plaintive metaphor.
It was like a game of Tetris when you start losing control and the pieces are getting closer and closer to the top.
Best understatement.
Things did not work out as I had hoped.
That sounds very Adrian Mole, actually, doesn't it?
The whole thing's so funny.
Best homage to Alan Partridge.
Meanwhile, I was throwing up in one of the gyms at Lynn Sport, the King's Lynn Leisure Centre. I then continued to be sick all the way from Norfolk to London.
Best music criticism.
I confess to Lennon being my favourite Beatle, although he was clearly a lefty.
Best travel writing.
I went on my first visit to Australia in September 2019. It was love at first sight, like Britain, but without the hand-wringing and declinism.
Just like Britain.
This quote has been slightly edited for comic effect. Best feminism.
Women are just as capable of making poor decisions as men. They just have had less opportunity.
Finally, most inadvertently alarming line.
I took this on in my usual style. Full frontal.
Next up, Rishi Sunak hopes that banning the sale of cigarettes to anyone born after 2009 will be his political legacy in lieu of anything else. Tuesday's first Commons vote showed that it has Labour support but divides the Tory ranks. And it's not just the smokers and tobacco lobbyists who object, but the civil libertarians too. As Kemi Badenoch put it, the principle of equality under the law is a fundamental one. It underpins many of my personal beliefs. We should not treat legally competent adults differently in this way, where people born a day apart will have permanently different rights. Obviously, that's Kemi Badenoch. But our own Rachel Cunliffe tweeted, I think for me it's the premise that you could have two different classes of adults with different rights. I think that's a really disturbing concept in law. And I think the popularity of the thought of a smoke-free generation has masked the weirdness of the premise. Meanwhile, the CAS review into healthcare for gender-questioning children and teenagers suggests at one point that there should perhaps be restrictions on care up to the age of 25. It says it used to be thought that brain maturation finished in adolescence, but is now understood that this remodeling continues into the mid-20s. So usually we work on the basis that anyone over 18 has equal competence under the law to make their own decisions if they are mentally fit. What happens when you start drawing new lines and carving out exceptions? So Zoe, we will start with the raw politics of it all. How did the vote play out?
So the bill passed its second reading. So MPs voted in favour of the bill by 383 votes to 67. There were 59 Conservative MPs who voted against the legislation. That includes Business Secretary Kemi Badenoch, who waited till the very last minute to make her key intervention on social media, which I'm sure was very popular in Downing Street. And Conservative Party Deputy Chair Jonathan Gullis also voted against it. There were some Tories who were listed as having no vote recorded, including Penny Mordaunt, who was also apparently grappling with whether or not to support the bill. Lee Anderson, maybe not a surprise, ex-deputy chair of the Conservative Party who defected to reform, also voted against it. But ultimately, the bill passed with a large majority because the Labour Party support it. And so Rishi Sunak got it through second reading. It will now go and it will be scrutinised line by line by MPs in committee stage. But obviously, it brought out some criticisms of Rishi Sunak's version of conservatism.
Now, obviously, one is loath
sometimes to be anywhere near the side of some of these people. But I find the kind of principles interesting. This is not a purely political rebellion. There are actually some ideas in play. Let's start with the enforcement argument. The idea that, you know, obviously one day we'll have 65-year-olds having to show ID to prove that they're not 64. The idea that black market always results from prohibition. Like, are there, for the people who have not taken money from Big Tobacco, you know, do you think there are sort of valid principled objections to this?
Yeah, I think, of course. I mean, any MP who looks at a bill and reads a bill and says, here are some practical issues with enforcement, issues with unintended consequences, things like that. I mean, that's good when that comes up. That's what MPs are supposed to do. And this is why you have committee stage, because that allows MPs to go through the bill line by line and suggest amendments. And then, of course, there are the ideological arguments as well, which are political, but they're also valid. Is this an impingement on people's liberties? And I think that is going to be a big division in the Conservative Party, because as we discussed in the first section, there is this division playing out between libertarians, big statism, small statism. And it really is a battle for the soul of the Conservative Party. So where Rishi Sunak was introducing what I think he thought was quite a one nation-y public health intervention that a lot of people would one day thank him for, I think he knew it was going to open up some of these dividing lines. And, you know, I think there are valid arguments made on both sides. I think Rachel's argument, I hadn't thought of it that way, but I think that that's a really interesting concept.
Well, as with, I think, free speech, you know, it is important to make the effort to extract it from the grubby mitts of the Tory right. Alex, what do you make of the argument about equality under the law for adults as an important principle?
It's a fiction.
Explain.
Especially in a country with constituent nations and devolved powers, it's a fiction. Even criminal responsibility, the rebuttable presumption, is 10 years old in the UK, but 12 in Scotland. And there are lots of differences like that. You know, up until very recently, I couldn't marry my partner. And up until even more recently, a straight couple couldn't enter a civil partnership. So,
and the age of consent used to be
the age of consent.
I mean, sexuality.
But I think the one that I would draw most closely, which is where I think my instinctive support for this stems, is the pensionable age. The government decides to tell people. I mean, last time it was anyone over 52 would work until they were 65, and anyone under 52 would have to work until they were 67. It happens that within the same group of people, there, you know, you have to separate age cohorts at some point and say above this line, it's going to be different.
John, let's go deep into neuroscience. Professor Peter Jones of Cambridge University, not that deep, of Cambridge University says transition from childhood to adulthood is long and gradual, isn't fully complete until the age of 30. A paper in The Lancet argues adolescence lasts until 24. But the law says that when you're 18, you can vote, buy alcohol, get married, serve on a jury, stand as an MP, be tried criminally as an adult, and so on. Now the neuroscience seems to be going, well, you're not really an adult yet. Is there any world you can imagine where the age of adulthood will be raised or should be raised?
I don't think so. I mean, there are campaigns, aren't there, for lowering it, for, you know, lowering the voting age to 16. Mm. And I kind of think 18 is probably about right. I mean, you know, you're not fully formed at 18. I'm not fully formed at 65. Fucking hell, you know. It's like, yeah. I think you know, you're definitely not fully formed at 18. But I think you're fully formed enough. Mm. And you know, arguably there are people of much older than that. That you know, there are people that you see and you think, oh my god, and they've got the vote. You know, so we can't sort of start saying, you know, you can't vote until you're, you know, until we deem that you're absolutely sort of fit and proper
until
to do so.
Your brain scan reveals.
Yes.
The neurons of all.
I mean, you say you can be tried as an adult, but actually between 18 and 24, you go into youth detention if you're convicted. You don't go into a jail. Only over 24. You go, so you're not fully treated.
Yeah, no, okay.
As an adult.
That's one area where it already makes that distinction. And the counter argument, Jen, on smoking, is that nicotine is so unusually addictive that it deprives smokers of agency. So they're not really making a decision. Do you think that is a principle that you can sort of establish without that sort of leaking into other areas? You can say it's just nicotine. Because that's sort of the argument that some health professionals are making. It's like, we're not really making a decision.
I mean, I'm really on the fence about this issue.
Yeah.
I you know, it's one of those things where I can say, well, you know, yes, but on the other hand, and I find it also quite bizarre that Rishi Sunak has got these two kind of polar opposite hills to die on here. So he's got the Rwanda bill, you know, which is a completely impractical, overexpensive madness. That he's trying to get through to be his, like, you know, I'm going to stop the boats. And it's not stopping the boats. And it's going to cost, you know, £500 million. Yeah. Pounds. And yet, also, oh, yes, come along, you know, anti-smoking. And so you sort of think, well, who are you doing this for?
Yeah.
Who are you? What are actually your politics?
And the really interesting question is, you know, this was a central Sunak pledge announced by him at the party conference. How does this man put together a manifesto for the next election if he cannot take his party with him on the most sort of simple, it's not simple, but you know what I mean, it's a limited issue, right? If his party splits into four different factions on this issue, how does he put together a manifesto? What does he say about taxes? What does he, you know, all of that stuff.
I just don't know whether I'm not sure whether he has thought through that principle, because that's why I'm on the fence. Because you can say, okay, well, the health argument is really clear. This is a sort of a slow motion abolition of smoking. And you go, okay, fine. Nobody's going to go, well, smoking's fine for you. But, you know, when I'm fine, and I very, very rarely read a Kenny Badenoch tweet and think, oh, I kind of see where the principle is there. And I just don't think he thought that through. Yeah. And the fact that this is sort of, that this does run against a certain school of conservative thought.
I mean, for me, it comes down to a very, very simple issue. If you want publicly funded healthcare, it is compatible with a certain level of paternalism from the state on health matters. You cannot have a completely free choice to do whatever, however harmful it might be, because that fuels the argument of someone else saying, well, I've made healthy choices, so I'll pay my insurance and you pay yours.
No, you see, I think the paternalism, you know, actually kind of plays into that. It's the idea that some people are less deserving of care. So I wanted to ask you about Wes Streeting, who was very into this, also wants to crack down on like vapes and junk food, and he does seem like he's going to be a very paternalistic health secretary. And I do worry about that. And about, because that, by doing that, it creates this thing. It's like, we've done all these disincentives. And if you insist on eating this or drinking that or smoking the other, then you are kind of like, should you be? I mean, he's not going to deny people care, but I do worry about that danger.
Perfect democracy, like, a perfect idea of liberty depends on perfect information. And we don't have perfect information. You know, not everyone understands things the same way. You have companies with a profit incentive who constantly skew that debate. And so you accept that there has to be some sort of state intervention, some sort of regulation. For me, this is close to the pension thing. What the government is doing is telling someone who is 18 today, let's say, that you will never be able to legally buy cigarettes in this country. So I see it less as this sort of ongoing process of, you know, constantly having different rules for a 65-year-old and 64-year-old, as much as a statement to people under X age that this will not be available at all to you. Which I'm quite relaxed about, to be honest. And the support for that, and what you were saying, Jan, about alcohol, for instance, about 10% of people who drink qualify as alcoholics under the medical definition. About 85% of people who smoke qualify as addicts under that medical definition. Right. And over 90% of smokers wish they had never started.
Those 15% must be having a good time.
Yeah, but over 90% of smokers wish they had never tried their first cigarette. And I think to me that settles it, actually.
Zoe, to return to the sort of this theme of like when you're an adult, you were the only panelist under 30. What do you make of this idea, the suggestion from Professor Peter Jones, that you are not actually grown up, fully grown yet?
I think he's probably right, unfortunately.
I was expecting unfortunately,
I think he's probably right. I mean, the age of consent is a legal boundary. It's there to protect. It's not saying when you get to the age of 18, you can vote with full capacity, because obviously everybody's capabilities and everybody's life experience and everybody's subject to trauma and all those kind of things change how able someone is to consent. And there's also power dynamics are a big part, especially in the age of consent. When we're talking about sexual relationships, power dynamics are a huge factor in that. So it's not binary. And so I do agree with the idea that consent and the ability to vote and the ability to drink and all those things are just okay at a certain age. I do think it changes, and I do think it will be different for everyone. And that's why I think, and this really came out in the CAS report, which we mentioned earlier, we really need to have a health system which is properly set up to be very patient focused, so that everybody is getting the care and the attention and the reviewing they need before they undergo, for example, a medical treatment that can change their bodies or whatever. So, because every person will be different, a 15-year-old may fully be able to consent to having, you know, medical treatment, but a different 15-year-old might not be able to.
Well, it's like, you know, the whole idea of Gillett competence, where you assess the individual, even under 16, can make decisions. Then over 16, you can consent to treatment if you're deemed competent. The bit I think that kind of alarmed some people there was this idea that actually it would go up to 25, until you turn 25, and that it's good that there would be counselling services for gender questioning young adults. But if that took the form of actually restricting their ability to consent to certain things, some people are saying, well, does that set a dangerous precedent? And that if you get the kind of people who are, you know, against transitioning, but are also against abortion rights and even contraception, which you, I mean, more so in America, but there are some people like that over here as well. Does that set a dangerous precedent where it suddenly goes, do you know what? These people can't, they can't really decide what to do with their bodies until they're 25.
Yeah, obviously that's a danger. But that's where I think, for example, if you have an abortion, you do have an appointment with a doctor, and they will ask you a number of questions to check that you're not being coerced, to check that you're of sound state of mind. Mm. That happens at any age, right? So really, in an ideal world, we'd have a health system where everybody is treated like an individual and everybody is properly assessed. Obviously, it would be really unfair if a 25-year-old had to overcome a whole different set of obstacles to a 26-year-old for something like transitioning. So I'm not sure about that. And I'm sure there are scientific arguments to it. There'll be medical arguments. There'll be philosophical arguments. And all of these things need to be considered. But I think really fundamentally what it comes down to is having a health system, especially a mental health system, that is properly resourced, and that people who want these things are able to get the support and the assessments they need, and they need to be thorough. And you know, if you go to a doctor and you want some contraception or any kind of medical treatment, you get what, 5 minutes with them, and they might tick a box. And that's not because they don't care, it's because they don't have the resource or the capacity. And actually, even in a 10-minute session, even in a half an hour session with a doctor, you're not necessarily going to elicit the right responses from a patient who you've just met about their medical history, about their history of trauma, about their history, their family history. You know, those things take time. So it's really, really complex. But I certainly don't think our health system as it is set up to deal with the complexity of those issues.
We've reached the end of the show. So what are the stories that have gone under the radar this week? Jan, I guessed.
My story that's gone under the radar is partly to do with a story that's like so far over the radar that I just wish they'd shut up about it, which is the Angela Rayner might have, you know, not paid, you know, a bit of capital gains tax. And all the time when I'm watching these programmes where they've got a Labour spokesman, I think, why isn't the Labour spokesman going, yes, but what about all your guys that owe £20 million? Why aren't the newspapers, you know, splashing on, there must be so much stuff to find out about all these, you know, the Tories and, you know, possibly others, I don't know. I can't believe the disproportionate amount of coverage that the Angela Rayner story is getting. Even today on the BBC, on the Daily Politics show, they're doing it again.
And I know. And the starting hook now is for everyone. This story is not going away. It was still on the front of a couple of papers yesterday. And it's like, that doesn't make it a fucking story.
Yeah.
The fact that the Daily Mail,
you
know, puts it on their front page every single day does not in itself make it worth exploring.
Yeah. I just think it's absolutely outrageous, and there are so many more serious stories that they should be focusing on, and so much more revenue they could get from all these bastards that never paid their bloody tax. Mm.
I think she's played it quite well, though. It's like with Starmer over Beergate, ridiculous word, where she's just basically like, well, if I'm found guilty, I'll resign, which Tories are very bad at doing. They're sort of going... If I found guilty, I will try not to resign until forced to several days later.
So. Yeah, I looked at her face in PMQs today when they brought it up, and she looked like a woman who was sleeping well at night to me. Yeah. Maybe I'll eat those words in a couple of weeks, but I thought she looked fairly happy.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Alex?
So my Under the Radar is about Andy Street and Ben Houghton being dragged down by Tory party brand, basically. Ben Houghton was elected in 2021 with almost 78% of the vote. One poll now puts him on 22 and another on 19.
Jesus, wept.
Andy Street, largely considered, I think, quite a popular mayor. In his area, the Conservatives are down by 28 points, 52 to 24. 52 Labour, 24 for Conservatives. He trails Labour by only 14 points, 28 to 42. And both of them are putting out leaflets that are very deliberately distancing themselves from the party. And I think if we go back 1 year exactly to this notion that Sunak was going to drag the party up because he was popular, and the opposite has happened, and the party is now dragging people who are personally popular down with it. I insist that it will either be an early election with Sunak at the helm or a later election, but he won't be leading the Conservative Party. There is no way he can
ride through this. Well, I mean, I haven't met many Conservative politicians, but I did interview Andy Street once, and he was just a genuinely intelligent, decent idea. He was it was in conversation with Sadiq Khan, and they obviously liked each other. He was obviously really intelligent. He was almost just like, "What are you doing in this party?"
And Michael Fabricant's partner, which I didn't know until very recently.
What?
Yes, yes.
For many, many years, and describe each other as their life partner. So
I met him when I did a gig for John Lewis, and he was managing director of John Lewis, and the woman organising, Andy Street loves Dead Ringers, you know, he's very excited about you coming, and there was little Andy Street loving his little burst of satire.
Zoe.
Fabricant. Wow.
It sounds like actually Michael Fabricant and Andy Street is the big under the radar story this week. But I'm going to bring the tone down slightly. So this is a really, I think, shocking story, especially in the context of the infected blood scandal and the post office inquiry and all these kind of bubbling government scandals going on. So thousands of carers have run up huge debts, been given criminal records and been forced to sell their homes because the Department for Work and Pensions have chased them for honest mistakes that officials could have spotted years earlier. So currently unpaid carers are entitled to about £81.90 a week. It's the smallest benefit. And they have to care for someone for at least 35 hours a week. They're allowed to work, but they can't make more than £151 a week after tax and expenses. If you make even a fraction more than that, even 50p,
you have to pay back the entire week's carer's allowance for the whole period. And basically, tens of thousands of carers have unwittingly fallen foul of this rule. DWP had the technology to automatically alert them and didn't. And now they're chasing them for the money. So
thousands of pounds.
Thousands of pounds. So Karina Moon, who is an unpaid carer to her 22-year-old disabled daughter, is being forced to pay back £11,000 after an earnings breach that amounted to £3 a week. After the DWP deemed that travelling to work was not an allowable expense. I mean, it's absolutely shocking. Yeah. Unpaid really carers in this country already are villainy. Way more likely to be in debt, way more likely to default on mortgages, things like that. They are basically doing a job that should be really provided by the state.
And their spirit already kind of, you know, I mean, how cruel and it's just terrible. Inhumane is that?
It's terrible. And when you think about the conversation we're having about postmasters at the minute, which is, you know, and all the kind
Kafka-esque.
Of... It's just, it feels like, how can this still be happening?
Does ITV do requests?
Well, yeah, they should. But yes, I don't let that story drop, I don't think. I think it's really important.
Well, this is just some light relief, and it's not under the radar in America, but maybe not everyone has been following it as closely as I have. Jury selection for Donald Trump's trial. Now, unfortunately, it turns out that a lot of jurors had been a little bit free and easy on social media with their opinions of Donald Trump. Since 2016. And this is just a brief extract from one of the people covering jury selection. It says, a prospective juror who reposted an AI-generated video in which AI Donald Trump says, I'm dumb as fuck, has been dismissed. Judge Merchant is reading Trump memes reposted by prospective jurors into the record and periodically apologizing for any offense given. The latest... Trump invites the Thai boys to the White House and the boys request to return to their cave. He's just like reading out like old topical gags about Donald Trump and dismissing people. So apparently it's actually proved surprisingly hard to find people who have not said something mean about Trump on Twitter.
But do you think you're going to end up with a jury that's all sort of pro-Trump if you kind of weed out all the people that are sort of, you know, said, you know, the odd kind of, you know, bad joke?
Well, the hardcore pro-Trump people generally are all like sort of hashtag MAGA.
Right.
So I think we've weeded out some of them as well.
Right, right, right.
But I think as this is in New York, it seems like it's not a particularly pro-Trump.
Yeah.
So it's hard. So I think they're just finding people who just like are completely zoned out from politics. But anyway, some good material. But who wants their old topical gags read out
thrown
in the court of law
face.
Like 6 years later?
Yeah.
And that's the show. Thank you to Zoe.
Thank you.
Alex.
My pleasure.
And our guest, Jan.
You're very welcome.
Stick around for the extra bit after Demon is a Monster by Corner Shop, and a big thank you to all of our new and old Patreon backers. You could join them for less than a quarter of the price of Liz Truss's new book a month and have a lot more fun getting the podcast early and without ads, plus lots more. Search Oh God, on our Patreon to find out how. We'll see you next time.
Big shout from me and thanks for your support to new backers Kevin Franklin, Jeremy Andrews, Lindsay Wallace and Lucy Tatner.
And a huge thanks from me on behalf of the whole podcast, and welcome on board to Jonathan Vaughan, Hexadismal, James Northcutt Smith and Ian Banbury.
And finally, thanks to me to Ed Sylvester, Lottie, Edward Eyre and Mark Sellers.
Thanks, everyone. It's been so great hanging out with the tofu-eating wokerati.
Oh God, What Now? Was written and presented by Dorian Linsky, with Alex Andreou, Zoe Grunewald, and Jan Ravens. It was produced by Chris Jones, with audio production from Robin Lieberman, video production by Kieran Leslie, and art by Jim Parrott. Managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, group editor Andrew Harrison, and Oh God, What Now? Is a Podmasters production. Hello again. Alex Garland's fourth movie as director after Ex Machina, Annihilation and Men is Civil War, an Apocalypse Now-style travelogue through an America ravaged by war between Washington and the secessionists of the Western forces. It's generated a great deal of discussion and controversy about its surprising political vagueness and the wisdom of making a movie about Civil War when some Americans are talking about the possibility of a real one. We've all gone to see it, not together, sadly. Like Andrea Leadsom's pizza gang. And we're going to unpack its ambiguities, like proper film critics. Zoe, first up, what did you think?
I liked it.
I went to see it in our local cinema on a Sunday night, and it was a sort of perfect Sunday night film. I didn't know what to expect. I thought there would be...
You thought it was a perfect Sunday?
I was just really relaxed.
Sunday night to like...
You spent your Sundays.
I like to be distracted brutal. From work just the right, next okay. day.
You'd want some executions. Everyone else is watching something nice with Bill Nighy and Judi Dench. That was a teaser for the bonus bit of this week's podcast. If you'd like a little bit more Oh God, What Now every week without ads and a day early, then you can sign up to back us on Patreon for as little as £3 a month. Also, bonus content, merchandise offers, reduced live show tickets, and all that jazz. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.